A Braniff International Airways Lockheed Electra is flying to Dallas, but they never arrive. What caused this flight to crash on this journey across some weather?
Welcome back to the Hard Landings Podcast, everybody. I'm Nick.
I'm Miranda.
And I'm Christy.
Hey, 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 hey.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hello. I lost a needle.
Nick's worst nightmare.
Yes.
And I'm not going to come to reality.
I'm not going to move from this chair. I'm going to die here.
By the way, I am 14.28% done with my project.
Nice.
Yay.
This is still an aviation podcast.
Yes. We do have new patron.
We do?
At least one new patron.
No.
Since the last time we recorded.
I don't
yes,
think so.
We do. Since the last time we recorded, we got a new one.
I don't think so.
Yes. Clark.
Thanks, Clark.
Thank you, Clark.
Welcome.
Hello. Welcome to the disaster show where we are disasters.
Yes. Welcome to the disaster shows. We are the disaster.
And we talk about disasters. Yeah.
And also welcome to Colleen.
Colleen?
Free.
Oh.
Free.
Okay.
Got it. Cool.
Free. Welcome. Therefore, we don't get an email.
No, we don't.
Cool.
But
cool.
I have the
cool,
list.
Cool. Okay, so that being said, you should do all the normal stuff as per usual. We will do trivia question answers in this episode. So you should check out the newsletter, and you should check out the merch page, and you should check out the Patreon.
Yeah. I haven't seen any new stories come in recently, but I know we have enough to do another episode, I think.
We have actually more than enough. There's been quite a few that have come
okay.
in.
Okay. We will do this soon.
So whenever.
Yep.
We'll do something. And also, I have a Miranda so done, and we need to do that, too.
Yeah.
Yay! Can't do it next week, because I'm taking my mom to dinner for her birthday. So,
right.
And we're doing early dinner, but that still means I'm not going to be able to be here till 7. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So, we will see. We're going to get through these things.
Oh, okay. You will get new stuff.
Yes, there's always new stuff. And there's so much stuff.
There's so much stuff.
Patreon anyways as
re-listen
well.
Re-listen to stuff. I don't know.
Dude, the blooper reel is going to be quality content.
Oh my
month.
God.
You should have heard some of the stuff that came from the episode with Brendan.
I'm sure.
Oh no.
I will listen to all of that at some point.
Oh gosh. Okay, well, with that being said, what are we covering today, Nick?
Today, we are covering Braniff Flight 352.
Thank you to Rich.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Rich.
It's kind of weird because it's fun. Or did he also request the other Braniff one?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, that would be weird if someone else did that and then you also did the other one.
I don't know how they got separated though.
Because we didn't want them to be next to each other. You want to know why?
Why?
It's because we didn't want all of the collisions that JJ, thank you
very
much.
Oh, yeah.
To be all together. And so we split them up that way, and that's why.
That's right.
If we had to do multiple collisions in a row, I would have died.
And the way it was before, we would have. And I was like, this is a bad idea. We should fix that.
As interesting as it is to talk about collisions, because they really are very interesting episodes
every
time. Oh, my
God, there's so much more work.
They are so much work. They are brain destroyers. Like, they just, they take a lot of work. I won't lie. Compared to the normal episode, it's
twice as much work.
Yes, so quite literally.
Be considerate when you give us one of those.
We do really actually like doing them, though, because they are interesting.
Oh, yeah. They're fascinating.
Super fascinating.
But legitimately, he was like, here's an entire email of all collisions. And I was like, why did you do this to me?
Like, oh, no.
But okay.
Anyways. This accident occurred on May 3rd of 1968.
1968?
Yeah, it's a oldie.
It's oldie, but a...
No, it's not a goodie.
Not a goodie.
I was going to say oldie, but a goodie, but it's not a goodie if it's on the podcast, so you know.
So Braniff is an interesting airline, and I know we didn't get to do the one that Brendan and Paige did, and I really appreciate that they did that. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Braniff because we don't really get to talk about them much, but they are the really interesting... They were like a very eclectic airline, and they have this cult following even today. Because they had these, like, really colorful, livery, crazy, different colored airplanes. That each one of them was a different color of the rainbow. But before that, they did have a standard livery. And this one was in that livery.
So was the one that we talked about previous to this.
Yeah, yeah. So this one being an L-188 Electra, Lockheed.
Lockheed L1. Electra.
Yep, Lockheed Electra. Which is a quad turboprop. So it did have turboprop for 1968. That's pretty good. Turboprops, of course, being relatively new at the time. But they did have a lot more power.
And they were pressurized.
Per weight, yes. And they were a lot easier to pressurize because you have a turbine. And a turbine creates pressure.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. What a concept. This one had the tail number, November 9707 Charlie. This was quite the flight. We're only talking about the first leg of this, by the way. But this was a flight from Houston to Dallas, which was Houston Hobby.
To Dallas Love.
Because those are the only two that existed at the time. They were the ones close to the city because the cities weren't that big yet. They were big, but not that big. And they didn't have big, giant international airports yet. And then from Dallas to Tulsa, and then to Fort Smith, which is in Arkansas, and then to Little Rock, Arkansas, and then to Memphis, Tennessee. So.
Okay, well, none of the rest of that happened.
Nope. We're only talking about Houston to Dallas. The captain for this flight was John Phillips. White.
I was like, John Phillips Souza?
Nope, John Phillips. He was 45 years old. At the time, he had 10,980 hours total, of which 1,380 were on the Electra.
Okay.
First officer was John Foster.
Oh, the Johns.
The Johns. He was 32 years old. He had 2,658 hours total, of which 1,820 were on the Electra.
I mean, not bad. I'm talking about 60s crew.
Yeah.
I mean, not
yeah.
that
means
bad.
They got war experience.
The war!
The war!
Actually, the first officer doesn't.
Oh.
Probably. It's too far away.
32. Yeah, he's
32 years old in 68. He would have been 68.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. He doesn't have any experience.
He would have been really young.
The captain.
He could have.
The captain, yes, probably. Yes.
The war!
The war.
The war.
The flight engineer was Donald Crossland.
Not a John.
No. Still white. Who was 28 years old and had 1,000 hours total, about, of which 754 were on the Electra.
Still more hours than you.
Yeah. Same age, too.
Dang That's it. Not hard.
When we hear about captains at, like, 26 with thousands of hours, yeah. that makes me sad.
What am I doing with my
life? Also, yeah. how?
Right? Seriously, though.
Money.
Also, it was probably significantly cheaper back
or
then.
Or knowing somebody.
You know a guy?
Yeah.
You know a guy.
I know a guy. But the other thing with that, too, not to get on a tangent, but back then, yes, hour requirements were lower. Also, pilots were not in really high demand. The whole thing with that is also because pilots weren't in shortage
right.
throughout most of history until recently when they were in very, very vast shortage, although the airlines are backing off a little bit. But because of that, it wasn't particularly difficult to get into the piloting career. Now that challenge is much more difficult and they are in shortage and there's a high demand for them because there's more and more flying, but a whole different discussion. At Houston, 80 passengers and 5 crew boarded the flight. The flight was scheduled to depart at 4 p.m. local time with a scheduled takeoff time of 4:05 p.m. local time. The flight was to fly on an instrument flight rules flight plan or IFR. With a cruising altitude of flight level 200 or 20,000 feet, and fly via Jet Route 87 to Dallas. It's a pretty direct route, pretty direct flight. Turns out there's not a whole lot between Houston and Dallas, because Texas is big.
Turns out, yeah.
Texas is big and not a lot of stuff.
Except Texas weather.
Yes, there is that. The estimated flight time was to be 52 minutes, which is pretty good, actually. For the era, because this is a turboprop.
Yeah, I'm like, it seems very, very, very long for same state travel.
But it does still probably take in the range of about 40 minutes, normally.
Today?
Yeah. Really? They're not close together. I don't think you understand. Texas is huge. Yes.
But to be fair, Colorado also seems huge as compared to some European and Asian countries.
Yes.
So.
Definitely.
Some states even.
I mean, Denver is like 2/3 the size of Belgium.
Yeah.
The flight left the gate at Houston on time, but they received a delayed takeoff time of 4:11 p.m., which is only like 6 minutes late. I don't even know why. Okay. Due to other traffic in the area, they say. It just seems kind of pointless to say, yeah, we're just going to make you wait for six minutes.
It seems, from what you guys have explained to me of the report, that they kind of are a little particular.
To some extent, yes.
Yeah.
The flight took off normally and climbed to cruising altitude normally, and the crew reported reaching cruise altitude at 4:30 p.m. in 40 seconds. 4:35 p.m. in 53 seconds, the first officer called Houston Air Route Traffic Control Center and said, quote, "A few miles down the road, we'd like to deviate to the west. Looks like there's something in front of us," end quote. that something being thunderstorms.
A thunderstorm.
Yep. Because Texas.
Because Texas.
And May.
For any of our international listeners who may not know, there's a certain area of the United States known as Tornado Alley. Though Texas does not technically fall into Tornado Alley.
Oh, yeah, they do. Some part of it does.
Not this part of it.
The top part of it.
Yeah, this part still does.
Okay, well, there is this section of the United States that is very prone to, well, tornadoes and also severe weather.
Yeah, severe thunderstorms. Hail, lightning, crazy rain, crazy thunderstorms.
Probably about this time in the 1900s. I hate that sentence. Mm-hmm. This would have been about the beginning of storm season.
Yep. In May. Yeah. Middle. Yeah. That.
Now storm season in Tornado Alley starts like now.
April.
Or earlier.
Yes.
I believe some states had tornadoes in March.
Yeah. Or you can live in Arkansas where they happen all year long, consistently the same every month.
Disgusting.
Ew.
Same thing in Louisiana.
Ew. Anyway, so there's some reference for international folk.
Yeah. The air traffic controller acknowledged this call from the first officer. Around that time, the flight was due to change frequency to the Fort Worth Air Route Traffic Control Center. So this request was passed to them by the Houston Air Route Traffic Control Center. So in doing this frequency change, they're changing the plan, but handing that plan to the other air traffic control center.
Okay.
Saying, this is your problem now.
Are they still separate air route traffic control centers?
I don't know. They might be.
I thought they... Because now air route traffic control centers cover huge areas.
Yes, that is true.
It's because they have more ability to do so.
Yes.
No, they're still separate.
Yeah, okay.
It's
big areas, that's why.
Yeah.
Still so really big.
The Houston Center controls the south part of Texas, part of Louisiana, part of Mississippi and Alabama, and Fort Worth covers...
Dallas.
Yes.
Everything in the north of Texas.
Part of Louisiana, part of Arkansas, part of Oklahoma, yeah. Part of New Mexico.
Makes sense. It's big.
Just a very tiny part of New Mexico.
Yes. Just before this handoff was to happen, the flight requested a descent to 15,000 feet, obviously from their 20,000 feet, but the air traffic controller did not hear this request. 4:36 p.m. and 15 seconds, the air traffic controller instructed the flight to contact Fort Worth Center and also let the crew know that the request to deviate had been relayed to that air traffic controller. 4:36 p.m. and 52 seconds, the flight contacted the Fort Worth Center and again requested the deviation to the west and a descent to 15,000 feet. The air traffic controller replied, quote, suggest deviation east, of course. The aircraft are deviating to that way at the present time, end quote. That is how it reads, by the way. I read that exactly how it reads.
Great.
But basically they're saying the air traffic, like they want to go to the west of the
storm. Everyone else is going east.
And everybody else is going east, and the air traffic controller's like, go east. That's our suggestion. The flight crew replied, quote, does it look good or better? On our scope here, it looks like the a little bit to the west would do us real fine. And it reads pretty much exactly like that.
So,
end quote.
We had this conversation when we covered the other Braniff crash, and a few of you will, you know, remember some of this, but did the planes have onboard radar at this point?
This one did.
Yep.
Okay. Is this, I'll wait for that. Never mind. I'll wait for that question.
Okay.
Because I have a feeling what's going on, but.
Yep, you do. You do, you do.
I think you're onto something.
If you're feeling some Garuda vibes.
Like, it looks like there's a hole, but really there's no hole. We covered that with the last brain of crash.
Well, yes. The cat's out of the box now.
Some of it.
So they fly into a storm.
Some of it. Anyway, it's daylight. It's not like they can't see this thing in front of them. They do. But anyways.
But they're trusting their radar.
They are also doing
more
that.
More than their eyes.
Yes, they are also doing that.
Which I don't know if that's a great idea.
It's not.
In retrospect...
It's not.
If you're like, oh, it looks like there's a hole, but that definitely doesn't look like a hole.
Right.
I feel like you should be like, you know, maybe.
The safer thing is just to stay away from it.
We should just go around it. Yeah.
They didn't do that.
They didn't do that.
They didn't.
So we're already giving away a lot, but there's still a lot of things to talk about. The controller then approved the deviation to the west, but told the crew to stand by on the request to descend. 4:37 p.m. and 23 seconds, the captain made an announcement to the passengers advising them about the weather at Dallas, as well as their estimated arrival time of 4:58 p.m., which was on time. He also advised the passengers that there was a, quote, little line of thunderstorms, end quote, ahead of them, and they would be deviating a bit to the west for a smoother and more comfortable ride. Yeah. 4:39 p.m. and 12 seconds, the air traffic controller advised the crew to descend to 14,000 feet. So even further than they were intending to descend. The crew acknowledged and began descending. 4:41 p.m. and 7 seconds, the captain made another announcement advising the passengers that he was turning on the seatbelt sign and the no smoking sign in case of turbulence.
Because you used to be able to shut that off.
Yes, and that's a thing. Turn off the no smoking sign, let them smoke, but because we're going to go through some turbulence and we don't want you to throw your cigarette on the ground.
Maybe, you know, just keep it.
We don't want your lit cigarette bouncing around the cabin. We're going to turn that on for a bit. Ah, the 60s.
Ah, the 60s.
Additionally, he told passengers that they would have a good view of the storms on the right side of the aircraft.
Is that a good
thing? You're going to have a good side of the storms here real quick.
Yeah. I feel like you don't want to look at thunderstorms
right
while you're flying on an airplane.
I do. I think it's cool, but I want to be around them, like not in them. I want to go around the outside. I have cool pictures of them from the sky, but I don't want to be.
I've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Before.
They're really cool. I just don't actively want to be flying into it.
No, I really don't.
It's a bad idea.
Then we get a Lanza problem.
Yes.
Wait, we should have discussed Lanza with these two.
That was also an Electra.
Okay, dang. Listen, Lanza, jungle, Peru, lightning, boom, someone lived.
Yes.
The plane exploded, she lived.
That's pretty much all we can talk about on it. There's a lot more to cover on it, but again, there's no report, so. Unless y'all live in Peru or want to go to Peru and go get it.
Please.
Someday maybe we will, but not high on the priority list right now. 4:42 p.m. and 20 and a half seconds. The controller advised the flight of Traffic, another Braniff Electra, at 10 o'clock and 8 miles, heading northeast at 13,000 feet, to the flight crew. The flight crew acknowledged this. At 4:43 p.m. and 20 seconds, the flight requested a further descent to a lower altitude, which was denied by the air traffic controller because of the other traffic. At that time, the air traffic controller asked the flight about their heading, to which the flight crew responded, quote, "We're turning over to a heading of 340 degrees now," end quote. So they were turning to 340 at that time to go around to the west of the storm. 4:43 p.m., the flight once again requested a lower altitude. So, just really beating this thing to death. We want to go down. The air traffic controller then cleared the flight to descend to 5,000 feet. 4:45 p.m. and 16 seconds, the captain instructed the flight engineer to turn on engine heat temporarily, at least on the number one engine, he said. We can talk about that later on, but that's kind of a moot point. 4:46 p.m. and 10 seconds, the air traffic controller asked the flight, quote, "Do you indicate the area you're going into there now as being ... fairly clear, or do you see openings through it?" End quote. So asking the crew, "Are you in a clear area? Like, yeah. Weather okay there?" The flight crew replied, quote,
"No.
It's not clear, ... but we think we see an opening through it," end quote.
That doesn't give me the
warm pretty general. Yeah. No, it's not. Definitely not a warm, fuzzy feeling on that, right? 4:46 p.m. and 32 and a half seconds, the flight asked the controller if there had been any reports of hail in the area that they were flying through. The air traffic controller, of course, replied to this, quote, "No, you're the closest one that's ever come to it yet. I haven't been able to anybody to, well, I haven't tried really to get anybody to go through it. They've all deviated around to the east," end quote.
Weird. So maybe you should do that.
Right. Maybe, just maybe.
Yes, and by the way, that is exactly how that thing is quoted, so.
I figured you read it like that.
I did. I read it like that very specifically on purpose. That is how it reads. I know it doesn't read well, but that's because they didn't say that well. So I just like the fact that the air traffic controller was like, "No, we don't know if there's any hail there because nobody's been flying through there."
Like, how would we know?
Yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't find out.
Right. Like, things might be getting hairy here. You should ask the air traffic controller. "Hey, air traffic controller, has anybody said anything weird is happening over here? Well, you're the only one that's ever flown through there while this has been happening, so I don't know. You tell me."
Yeah. I don't know.
Things only get weirder from here. A short time later, the sound of the landing gear warning horn began sounding in the cockpit.
What?
And the captain told the crew, quote, Let it ring.
What? Quote.
Why is the landing gear warning horn going off?
I have so many questions.
That doesn't make sense.
Not to give away too much, but they found the aircraft with the landing gear extended.
What?
We'll talk about that later on.
We will?
I'll talk about it later on.
Hold on. Someone f***ed up. Wait, what?
No, they did this on purpose. It probably was company procedure because there are procedures for this even today.
Then why the hell would someone ask why the warning horn went off?
The flaps were not extended, therefore the landing gear being down creates a horn. So the captain just said, let it ring. We'll talk about all that later on.
No. No.
They're doing all of this because they may or may not be going through some turbulence.
May? I think that's not a may or may not situation. I think it's a they're going through turbulence.
Yes,
situation.
They're now at a low altitude and going through turbulence, in case you're wondering. 6:47 p.m. and 20 seconds. The flight crew requested from the air traffic controller to make a 180-degree turn.
Ha! We're regretting our decision!
Things are not going well. Things are not going well. We want to go back.
Oh, no!
We have to go back. The air traffic controller approved the turn to the, quote, right or left. The air traffic controller was like, huh, sure.
Told you so, yep.
Don't care. You go left or right, but make your 180-degree turn. 6:47 p.m. and 35 seconds, the flight crew acknowledged this clearance. This was the last time that the flight would be heard from.
Yeah, not surprising.
A short time later, the air traffic controller tried to make radio contact, but was unsuccessful. And in looking at the radar, they also could not locate the aircraft on radar. However, there's a big, giant caveat to that. Put a big, giant asterisk on that. Because it turns out that air traffic controller also couldn't see any airplanes.
What? Is it because of the storm?
Yes!
Because they're so low?
Primary radar.
It's both radar, actually.
Oh.
Both of them picked up the storms and couldn't detect airplanes through it.
What? What a freaking useless piece of equipment.
I know, and it was designed, the secondary was designed so that it was supposed to be able to see through storms, but they found that the air traffic controller couldn't see anybody and didn't tell anybody.
Oh, well, that's not great.
Nobody was told that their radar contact was lost at any point in time. But he couldn't see any airplanes.
He also was told that they went around the storms, so.
Right.
But then how do you avoid traffic? I'm confused.
Right. So some traffic shows up in certain areas, but anything that's nearabouts the storm, he couldn't see.
Awesome.
Yeah, cool. Anyways, that's a thing. 6:47 p.m. and 41.3 seconds.
Why are we doing fractions of a
You'll
second?
See.
Okay.
6:47 p.m. and 41.3 seconds, the fire warning bell began sounding in the cockpit. 6:47 p.m. and 41.9 seconds, which is 0.6 seconds later. How they figured that out is
a CVR.
Astonishing. Yes, it is.
They clearly had a CVR.
Yes, they did. The aircraft began breaking apart.
What? That's crazy.
As the right wing tore from the aircraft, and all sections of the aircraft fell quickly toward the ground. The left wing also eventually separated.
I mean, when you got no wings, you got no flight. Boo-boo.
No. And they were not very high up.
They also lost parts of the tail.
Yes.
Which is another
big no-no.
Nope.
Witnesses.
No tail, no airplane.
So this gets interesting. Witnesses saw the aircraft falling to the ground in flames. Some saying that they saw an explosion before it fell. Some also claiming, I guess I can put this part in there because I've read it. Some also claiming that they saw lightning nearabouts the aircraft at the time of the explosion.
Twas seent.
But we'll talk about that later on. The aircraft fell to the ground into a field about a half mile east of Dawson, Texas, at 4:48 p.m. The impact of the aircraft into the ground was a little more than significant, completely destroying the aircraft. And unfortunately,
I would say so.
Yes, and unfortunately, all 85 on board perished in the accident from impact.
Yeah, one might say they could definitely see the storm outside of the aircraft when they were outside of the aircraft.
Yeah. So I've left out some key things because this, even though we gave away a lot, it's not what you think.
You mean it's not structural failure due to turbulence?
It's that.
It is that. However, it does go beyond that, though, because it's not just per se turbulence.
Oh, and lightning?
Nope. That actually had nothing to do with it.
Lightning had
They found that it wasn't hit.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, they did.
Then they
stated in the findings there was no evidence that it was struck.
That's a different statement.
There's no evidence. Therefore, it probably wasn't hit. Anyways. They stated in the findings that they don't believe it was part of the accident.
Lightning did not cause the in-flight breakup.
No, it did not.
Oh, I never said it did.
That is a very specific way that I worded that.
I said turbulence did. I never said lightning did.
What about... Anyway, this investigation was performed by the NTSB, and they were able to retrieve both black boxes from the wreckage.
It's a very new NTSB.
Yes.
Well, and also, like, good on them for having a CVR and an FDR.
Yeah.
Because, like, that was pretty early on.
Yeah, however, the
Electras were not very old at that point. They were relatively new, and because they were newer, they were built, and they were also more modern prop-type aircraft because they're turboprops. So they were built with CVRs and FDRs.
However, they were mechanically damaged.
Yes.
However, they were not fire damaged, so they were able to retrieve a readout from both.
Remarkable.
Pulling that double however out on you.
Yep.
But before that, it was obvious early in the investigation that there was an in-flight breakup due to overloading on the airframe. Now, you may ask, how might that be obvious? Any ideas, Randa?
Oh, I know. It's because of the way the brakes were.
Yeah.
When they found the aircraft.
Correct.
So when metal breaks in overload, it usually breaks...
jagged.
It's jagged, and it's at a 45-degree shear angle. It's especially if it's in pure axial tension. That is how overload reflects.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying that's what happened here, but they were definitely jagged edges.
That's what happened here.
And so that's how, that's how a lot, like we've talked about fatigue before, but that's how they can tell if it's a fatigue fracture or if it's an overload fracture, is depending on if it's a straight across break,
right.
It's fatigue. Mm-hmm. And if it's jagged, it's from overstress.
Yes.
Technically. I don't know. Like, there's a bunch of other stuff that goes with that, too, but I'm not a mechanical engineer. That's Christie's job, so.
Anyway, so the question becomes, was this due to the aircraft strength or an outside overload condition? We're going to address the former. The first aspect of aircraft strength that they looked at was the design structural strength of the Electra.
And if you listen to the episode I did with Brendan, this starts to sound familiar.
Yes, it does.
However, I did not listen to that episode. But the history of the L-188 Electra, along with the metallurgical examinations of this one in particular, showed that design was not causal.
Yeah, so basically, it was a different airplane that I covered with Brendan. It was a BAC-111.
Yeah.
But they did the same thing. They were like, yeah. Was it the plane? Aircraft that wasn't strong enough, or was it an outside force? And they did the same thing. That's why I brought that up.
Gotcha.
I will argue that, okay, yeah, it was all within the design limits, everything that happened. However, maybe the design limits weren't enough.
They did not find that to be a problem.
At the time.
Which is fair.
Today, would it be different?
Yes.
Probably.
Aircraft have a little higher tolerance.
But at the time, it was within tolerance.
Yes.
The next aspect of aircraft strength was prior damage. This aircraft had experienced two prior incidents of turbulence that warranted inspection, as well as instances of high in-flight or high landing loads, one of which ended with a left gear up landing accident.
Huh?
I don't know. Each of these incidents was recorded in the maintenance records as being repaired according to the existing requirements, and investigators found that there was no damage from any of those incidents remaining.
Okay.
Next! Let's look at our favorite subject that Miranda, brought up.
Fatigue.
Da-da-da.
The FAA's records of all U.S. registered Electras showed 545 reports of wing cracking or corrosion, including reports of 748 individual cracks, 89% of which were between the fuselage and the inboard engines.
That's
horrible.
Things that are not good.
Guess where the wing broke off on this Electra?
Right, exactly up there?
Yeah, right up next to the fuselage.
The accident aircraft was responsible for four of those reports. The first three reports totaled to 14 cracks, 13 in the left wing. One of those was a 39.5-inch crack in the right wing, number four upper plank. First of all, how long?
Yeah, that's not small.
39.5 inches.
They were just cool with that, huh?
Well, that's the point at which they reported it.
And I repeat, they were just cool with that, huh? Because clearly it had cracked before then. Because it
was 39.5 inches long?
Yeah. Oh.
Also, this crack, you want to know where it was? Not where you think.
Nope.
It's not on the underside of the wing?
No. It was on the upper side, and it was just outboard of where the right wing had separated.
Yikes.
One might, in fact, call that sus.
In fact, it is suspicious.
Because of this, the possibility that prior damage caused the wing to fail at less than it was designed to is not zero. But investigators also deemed it unlikely, given that the most recent report and its repair was less than a year prior to the accident.
Hmm. What are you showing us?
I looked up Dawson, Texas on a map. There's a Braniff 352 memorial in the field where it happened.
Oh, okay. Oh.
It's right there.
The next subject they brought up was defective material, and then didn't talk about it.
Excellent.
Because they gave me all these bullet points, and they're like, we'll talk about them in succession. And I'm like, what? Okay. So clearly the material wasn't defective. Okay, well, so odds are not zero, but are unlikely that Correct. It was structural. So what's our other option? Outside overload factors. First subject.
Makes a distance based on the fact that they were on in a thunderstorm.
Yes. Yep. The first subject I will talk about actually directly leads into the next subject, so we're just going to talk about it all as one. So let's talk about a potential for a lightning-induced explosion.
That sounds fun.
Awesome. Yeah.
We already kind of talked about this a little bit, but...
Witnesses reported lightning near the aircraft immediately followed by a flash of fire or an explosion before the aircraft fell engulfed in flames. Sus.
Definitely.
Definitely suspicious.
The investigators considered the possibility of lightning triggering an explosion in a fuel tank or igniting fuel fumes, but there was no evidence to support this theory. Almost.
Almost.
There was some evidence of overpressurization in the outboard end of the number 4 fuel tank, but the evidence doesn't explain why the right wing separated between the fuselage and engine 3. Basically, the overpressurization of the fuel tank was on, like, towards the tip of the wing.
Yeah, that wouldn't make sense why the fuselage broke apart. That don't make a descent.
Another lightning-based theory was explored, that the lightning caused the pilot flying to lose control either by temporarily blinding him or affecting his attitude instruments. But investigators determined that even had that been the case, the fire would have been more directly causal.
Yes, to the crash rather than not.
Yeah?
Correct.
Okay, so your pilot's a little blind from the flash. You're missing a wing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that ultimately doesn't matter.
So, now let's discuss some turbulence. Or spicy air.
Spicy air.
Because this goes a little beyond turbulence, too, I would say. I mean, turbulence is definitely part of that, but also just wind forces.
Spicy air. The FDR recorded turbulence, which it does using an accelerometer.
Yes, of course.
Which measures G-forces, measures acceleration. As the flight approached the storm in its path, and the first officer commenced a gentle turn to the right 30 seconds before the catastrophic failure. And halfway through that turn, there was a spike of 2.7 Gs.
That's not small.
It is not small.
And the bank angle increased to 66 degrees. Normal turns are like 15 to 30 degrees.
Yeah.
The bank angle increased over the next 10 seconds to 110 degrees.
Which is inverted.
And the pitch decreased to 40 degrees nose down.
So we're already descending now at a high rate of speed.
Into a spiral. The pilot tried to recover, but doing so imposed bending and torsion moments to the right wing that exceeded its ultimate strength, such that the upper planking of the right wing was subjected to compression forces beyond its ultimate strength. Whenever you hear beyond its ultimate strength, it broke.
Right. That is the point at which it breaks.
That means it broke, yes.
Ultimate strength is where it breaks.
At which the lightning struck. The combination of the recovery forces and the ball of fire from the end of the fuel tank resulted in failure of the wing structure. So it's a combination of factors.
Yep.
The wing was bent and twisted off from the attempted recovery out of the spiral. Evidence also showed that the right horizontal stabilizer failed in bending due to the high angle of attack position, but it was also washed by unburned fuel, which means it happened after the right wing failed. Because after the right wing failed, it sent fuel everywhere, it got on the tail broke off.
Got it.
One of the only ways that we can actually tell timeline of the breakup.
Right.
The right wing and right horizontal stabilizer failing, but not the left side components is indicative of the attempted recovery from the spiral. The left components were not subjected to the same extreme forces. So this ultimately makes sense. And that's how they were able to determine that it was actually the pilot trying to get out of the dive.
Right.
That caused it to break up.
That's correct.
So either they were going to die from turbulence,
or they were going to die from him trying to save them from turbulence.
Right.
So there was a lose-lose type of situation.
Exactly.
So, but the crazy thing about this means that the accident isn't caused by the turbulence directly.
No.
Technically, in this case, it was not.
If he had done nothing, then yes.
Right. It was caused by the attempted recovery from the turbulence. So, in actuality, that means this was entirely pilot error.
Okay, it's pilot error for more reasons than that.
Yes, it is.
Which segues into the next point of...
I wouldn't say entirely, because...
Yes, it was.
Well, apart from the fact that they flew into the storm.
Yes, but then the recovery was also pilot error.
But that's not what I mean, though.
It's not error, though.
It's not error.
No.
Because it's pilot...
Yes, it's pilotage.
Pilot-induced.
Yes.
Yeah, because I wouldn't say it's an error, because he was trying to save the airplane.
Sure.
But they shouldn't have been there to begin with. Which so I understand why you would say that.
Right, which is why it's entirely pilot error.
It's not pilot error, though. It's the recovery was not pilot error.
No, the recovery was not, but the accident
was
still caused.
Them flying into... Yes. It was caused by pilot error, but it wasn't entirely...
The breakup
was not pilot error.
It's pilot-induced.
Can you see how the NTSB ends up in arguments?
Yeah.
Because I'm about to punch you.
But it's true.
Anyway.
I understand why you say that, but go on.
The next question in the investigation was how the crew ended up flying into the storm in the first place. And Miranda's really good at this job.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they had flown the reverse route several hours earlier without any thunderstorm activity on that route, but they had received information from their airline about the condition and extent of the severe weather. They also saw the storm from 60 miles away.
Yes.
They're like, oh yeah, look, that's a storm.
There it is.
Additionally,
60 miles from that.
They were mildly, maybe not so mildly, told that when they wanted to divert west, that all other aircraft, including aircraft from Braniff, were going east.
Yep.
Yes.
So maybe.
Just maybe. You should also go east.
They did not.
Investigators point out that based on how the radar antenna was configured at 8 degrees on the accident aircraft, the onboard weather radar would have shown light areas or separation between cells to the west. But this is deceptive in a way we haven't discussed in a long time. Weather radar works by calculating how much of an emitted signal bounces back to the radar. Rain and thunderstorms are more reflective, and so the more signal that bounces back, the more severe the weather, with one exception. Hail has a lesser reflectivity than other forms of moisture, which causes it to show as lighter on the radar.
Yes.
When in fact, it is horrendous. If anything's going to be severe or indicate a severe storm, it's hail.
Right.
Especially in Tornado Alley.
That is correct.
It's usually when hail starts popping up that tornado, what's it called? Before warning. Tornado watches and warnings become in effect.
Absolutely. 100%. Which we haven't had any here yet.
Mm-mm. Yet.
Yet.
But we haven't had many thunderstorms yet.
Not yet.
We are approaching storm season.
Very rapidly now.
I am so excited. I am not.
Anyway, that's all I've got.
Cool.
Got it. Also, if you... listen to my episode with Brendan a few weeks ago. I mean, Chrissy did a better job at explaining why there's holes, but that the same thing happened, right? They thought there was a hole.
Yep.
They went through the hole. It was not a hole. And
it's
the
hail.
Airplane broke apart.
Yep.
I don't think they actually reached the hail.
Yeah.
But
they didn't reach the storm in the one I covered with Brendan. It was just the immense amount of...
spicy air?
Spicy air that hit the airplane.
Spicy, spicy. Yeah, because primarily what happened, it wasn't even necessarily, I mean, the turbulences did cause the airplane to do the initial tilt, but then wind forces and such are what continue to cause it to
invert and spiral,
which isn't necessarily, I mean, yes, wind causes turbulence, but also continuous wind gusts and heavy wind gusts can cause it to worsen. And there was a lot of that when you're flying through a storm, because storms are nothing but very violently moving air.
Yes.
That's spicy
what it
air.
Is. Right.
There you go.
Cool. We'll take a break, and then we'll do the normal stuff.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Okay, we're back. They do have all the normal sections in this because of this being the NTSB. So we'll start with the findings, which actually they had quite a few, but they are still relatively succinct for the era. They found that the aircraft had been involved in a previous accident. Fun fact.
Didn't I say that?
They found that the aircraft was repaired and inspected in accordance with the FAA regulations for a, quote, hard landing, end quote.
Yeah, that collapsed the gear.
Yes, I know. I just wanted to do it for that. That's all. I'm sorry. I know you mentioned it.
I'm also hardly one to talk. I put a hard landings thing in our wedding vows.
Yes, by the way, this podcast was mentioned in our wedding vows. so good.
Multiple people were thankful for that because it made them stop crying.
Yeah. It was a wonderful wedding.
Oh, apparently Ben's wife was laughing hysterically throughout our entire set of vows because she was not warned.
Ah, I see.
About our propensity for
aviation.
Got it. Anyways, the aircraft was not checked for alignment after being subjected to excessive in-flight loads while attempting to get a main landing gear down, nor was such a check required. So they had been jerking the aircraft around trying to get the landing gear to drop.
But and it didn't. Why?
And they didn't do a check on that. Don't know. Whatever the case, landing gear didn't drop.
That was while they were flying to Dallas, right?
No, it was in a different flight altogether. Oh. This was months previous.
Oh.
It's a totally different accident. They found that it has been calculated that the L-188 wing could fail at 275 KEAS at a load factor of between 4.2 and 4.5 Gs. And at the same approximate load factor in a speed range of 300 to 350 knots, indicated, in unsymmetrical gusts. A failure at 270...
Asymmetrical?
It says unsymmetrical.
Weird.
I know. A failure at 275 KEAS at a load factor of between 4.2 and 4.5 G could result from either maneuver or gust-induced loads. It is also possible to fail the wing in the 300 to 350 knot indicated airspeed range under a combination of maneuver and unsymmetrical gust loading. Subsequent to that, they found that the flight recorder of the aircraft recorded a 4.35 G maximum load at failure.
So it even was more tolerance than they were expecting.
Not quite. It was between 4.2 and 4.5, which is actually exactly correct. 4.35 is dead in the middle of that. So, yeah. It failed exactly when they thought it would. They found that all aircraft systems were capable of normal operation and there were no evidence of a malfunction of any of the systems prior to the breakup. Note that the aircraft had no fault in the accident. It was did exactly as it was designed. They found that there was no evidence of a lightning strike on the aircraft. They found that the crew had personally observed the weather during its formative stage while on a flight from Dallas to Houston. So they had already seen the thunderstorm before while flying from Dallas to Houston earlier that day. Now they were going back the other direction, like 2 hours later, and there it was again. A thunderstorm.
A wild thunderstorm.
A wild thunderstorm. In the wild. Where they were. They found that Braniff 352's crew insisted on deviation to the west. Subsequent to that, they found a westerly deviation and penetration would have been a shorter route and would have taken less time. So the idea was obviously to go more direct to Dallas and not have to go all the way around to the east. One might say that's continuation bias.
I wouldn't just say that. I would confirm.
That's what's happening. They found that Braniff 352's crew should have been aware of the direction of movement of the storm system to the southeast from weather information available at Houston and their earlier observations. They found that the storm cell precipitation echo blocked out all other targets on the air traffic controller's scope in the area of the storm, even though circular polarization was in use. Circular polarization being the secondary radar's tool that is meant to see aircraft through storms.
So maybe get that checked out, huh?
Well, this storm was just so severe with so much hail because it turns out the aircraft hit hail that they couldn't see anything with that radar through the storm. Now we have much more
advanced
technology.
We have the technology.
We have the technology. So this is not a factor anymore. They found that the controller did not inform Braniff 352 that radar contact was lost. Yet again. Didn't tell anybody. We don't know what friggin' thing about where you are. Just didn't say anything. Bothers me a little bit.
It bothers me kind of a lot of it.
Because also the air traffic controller had the storm on radar, and if he could see where the aircraft was in relation to the storm, that air traffic controller probably could have stopped the whole thing and says, it looks like you're about to fly through the thick of it, actually. They found that the captain of Brand of 352 told the co-pilot, this is the fun thing. Sorry, I should preface. I left this out of the story because I wanted to make you mad, but I wanted to wait.
Oh, that's not good. Okay, I'll put my stuff down and I'll listen. Okay, what?
They said this out loud.
Oh, no.
And it was caught on the CVR.
Oh, no.
They found that the captain of Brand of 352 told the co-pilot, or the first officer, not to talk to the air traffic controller too much because they were, quote, trying, end quote, to get the crew to admit that they had made a big mistake by going through the storm system.
Yep, did!
Out loud, the captain said, don't talk to him too much about the storm, because he had already asked about the hail. And it was after that the captain told the first officer, he's like, don't talk to him too much about the storm, because we don't want him to be like, I told you so about this.
But he did tell you so!
And look what happened.
What?
They said that out loud. The captain said that out loud to the first officer.
With full chest voice.
Yep. They heard it on the CVR. He said, don't talk to the air traffic controller too much about that, about the storm, because they're trying to get us to admit to having made a big mistake.
No, they're trying to make sure you're okay, you dip. You're the one who flew through the goddamn thing to begin with.
Right. Everybody else was going a different direction for a reason.
You dingus.
You know, it's really mad to, or it's really fun to make you mad.
Yeah, it is.
The f***?
And
that's a,
could not have been more obvious that they made a big mistake. And the air traffic controller got to have that anyways when they decided we need to make a 180 degree turn.
Yeah. Were you expecting them not to say anything after you said that?
Right.
I'm confused.
Yeah, I left that part out. It wasn't in the story, but I left it out because I didn't want to give everything away for one and two. That was maddening.
God.
The fact that they called that out too in the story, they were like, yep, the crew knew they made a mistake and they didn't want to admit it. Like, they knew. They knew.
They knew.
And when they asked about the hail, that's because they were getting pelted with it.
Is there hail by chance?
And it turns out when you're moving that fast, hail can do some serious damage.
Yeah, just look at, we talked about this when we covered the Brain of Flight a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the Delta Airlines flight that landed
here. Yeah.
And how freaking messed up that airplane was.
Uh-huh.
It was screwed up.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to it.
Right.
Because we talk about the second half, we talk a lot about Delta. It was like 610 or something like that.
Yeah. And the fun thing with that is the radar tracks from that day, because of course all the radar, like FlightAware and
everyone went around that airplane.
And literally, like, they were showing all the tracks from around that time period, and everybody went around it, and there's just one airplane that went right dead through the middle.
This is exactly like what this is happening right here, is straight through the middle of the goddamn storm when everyone else went around it.
Yeah.
Except this one didn't land.
Correct.
It crash landed.
Yes, it did.
It didn't even crash.
Nope.
It just crashed.
Correct. All right, anyways. They found that the consensus of the groups... Sorry, I should clarify the groups. There was three groups that studied the flight recorder traces. So where it was and everything. So anyways, they found that the consensus of the groups was that the aircraft was upset subsequent to the initiation of a right turn to reverse course. So it was already being...
They were 180-ing.
Thrown about by turbulence, and then that was just made worse by the turning. They found that during the upset, the aircraft rolled to the right to a bank angle in excess of 90 degrees. They found that the aircraft also pitched nose down to approximately 40 degrees. And they found that the heading information being fed to the flight recorder would be erroneous in steep bank angles due to, quote, gimbal errors, end quote.
Gimbal errors.
Gyroscope errors.
Right. So that can happen for a multitude of reasons. Now, we design gyroscopes a little bit differently these days, but that can happen if the gyroscope has either a sudden jerk or if beyond a certain angle, there is something that causes it to hit something. So now you don't have proper data because that gyroscope has struck something and doesn't have the correct angle data anymore.
Fun fact, we covered that in an episode very early on. TWA mm-hmm. 260, was it 260?
Yeah.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
The one that crashed.
Yeah, in New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. In La San Diaz.
Yeah. They found that the NASA studies indicate the maneuver which preceded failure of the wing of the aircraft was well within the control and performance capabilities of the Electra aircraft. So all the maneuvers up until the point of destruction, of failure, were perfectly handleable by the aircraft. They found that the rapid increase in airspeed ceases. Yes, that's what it says. The rapid increase in airspeed ceases, and acceleration force increase begins and peaks out at 4.35 Gs. They found that the initial structural failure was the compression failure of the right wing upper plank at WS-101, being wing structure 101. They found that this failure was the result of positive bending and leading edge up torsional moment in excess of those for which the aircraft was designed. This is the thing that we didn't want to get too deep into, but basically forces were pushing up on the wing. And not only that, but they were pushing up from the leading edge. Mm-hmm. So not only did the wing bend upward, it also twisted. And that's specifically how it broke.
Bueno. Yeah.
It broke in torsion.
Bending and torsion.
Yes, bending and torsion.
Torsion is just a fancy word for twisting.
Yes. It was bending upward and twisting, and it broke. It done broke.
As I would think it would.
Yep. Now, here's one I would like to disagree with.
Oh.
Okay.
And I think you will, too, because you said it out loud.
Oh.
Oh.
They found that there was no evidence of any significant pre-existing structural damage observed in the wreckage, and the nature of the primary failure is not that which would be expected if a crack had precipitated the failure.
I mean, it wasn't the cause.
No, however, there was significant damage prior.
They did find, like, fatigue.
There was a crack.
There were previous reports of it.
Yes, there was previous reports of cracks.
They did not find actual fatigue cracks in the wreckage. However, I would have loved to reanalyze that wreckage with today's technology and see if we could prove them wrong.
Agreed. Yep.
Because, how many reports of fatigue across the fleet?
Yeah.
A lot.
Over 500? That's insane.
I don't like that.
That's a lot.
A lot.
That's a lot.
Especially over 700 individual cracks found?
Right. Especially for an aircraft that wasn't particularly that old. Like, the Electras weren't that old at the time. Anyways.
It is one of those times that I'm not going to take that finding verbatim.
Right. They found that no in-flight fire existed before the integrity of the wing fuel tanks were disrupted by the breakup. The fuel so released was ignited by some means, creating the ball of fire observed by ground witnesses. No, really. I always wonder, though, what lights that aflame? I mean, I guess it's just metal on metal sparking, but usually jet fuel, be it what that's what they probably would have been using for this, requires a very high
lightning
temperature point. That's the only thing I think, but that's not, this is, I mean, we've talked about plenty of instances where
They found the overpressurization in the number 4 fuel tank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there's lots of instances where we've talked about aircraft falling in flames with fuel tanks burning, and I'm like, how?
Okay, but we also usually talk about jet airliners that have combustion in the engine, so there is a spark.
Right, but then it would have to feed back up the fuel line.
It just needs to be in the air.
Right.
If there's any fuel fumes anywhere.
Right.
Pachoom.
Ergo, yes. Concorde.
Yes. Of course. But still, I don't know. It's a whole thing. Obviously, it happens. Here's the thing.
Here's the rub.
They found that the lightning, which occurred at about the same time the ball of fire was observed, according to ground witnesses, was not a factor in this accident.
No. I would not say...
I wouldn't say it's causal.
No.
I would say it's a factor.
Maybe.
I mean, they got hit by lightning. Okay, cool.
I don't know.
But
we don't know that. We still don't know that.
Failure.
Yeah.
Was truly the cause.
Yes. Absolutely. We still don't know. And actually, a lot of the witness reports don't put the lightning strike having hit the aircraft. There were 75 of them, by the way. And over 40 of them didn't say the lightning struck the aircraft. But they said that there was lightning at the time that the aircraft was seen falling in flames. Nobody actually saw it explode, by the way, and break up because it was in the clouds. They had seen it for a moment passing between clouds just before it then fell out of the clouds in flames. Two more findings. They found that the visual perception of the pilot might have been reduced by a near lightning strike.
Yeah.
I would Again, say not so. Causal.
No.
No.
But... It found that the reduction of visual perception or the startling effect of a near lightning strike would not have been sufficient to cause over control of the magnitude to cause an upset by an experienced airline pilot.
Yeah. I was like, as far as you're aware.
Right. And this being said, this is actually more specifically talking about not even like the visual aspect, but like the fact that like maybe lightning happened and that could have surprised the pilot. There's no amount of surprise from that lightning that would have caused the pilot to over
control
the aircraft like they were doing. Yeah. That was purely just because of the forces being exerted on the aircraft.
From spicy air.
Spicy air. And that's it for the findings. There are a lot that I didn't do. There were 56 of them in total, and I did less than half.
That's a lot for a
It really is. That's short what we That's what we said.
I know.
Most of those were really short, you heard, but I did over 20 of them.
The board determines that the probable cause of this accident was the stressing of the aircraft structure beyond its ultimate strength during an attempted recovery from an unusual attitude induced by turbulence associated with a thunderstorm. The operation and the turbulence resulted from a decision to penetrate an area of known severe weather.
That, of course, being the
I agree.
The whole thing. So, I read the recommendations section, and it says recommendations. However, it's actually one, and it's 2 pages long.
Oh my God.
That's ridiculous.
And I will not read it, because—
You shall summarize?
It's not worth, yes, it's not worth reading about. But the whole idea here, they recommend it to the FAA, basically, as well as— inspectors and aviation organizations in general.
Hey, everyone!
Yeah. That there be some amount of study and emphasis put on if you see it, don't fly into it.
Weird. What?
So the whole, this whole recommendation, of course, they talk about the specifics of the aircraft and how it broke apart and the things that happened and why the weather caused that. But the whole thing breaks down to
it did break down.
Policies, procedures, and training, as well as informational programs related to accidents from severe weather and training on severe weather, and saying, your radar is probably not right. Don't go into it.
Yeah.
Don't even think about it. If you can see it, don't do it. Just go around. Go around it. I know it sucks. I know it takes time. Hey, more money.
Yeah.
So go around.
Solid rule of thumb. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the whole thing. That's what they summarized in 2 whole giant pages. They talk about taking SIGMETs more seriously. So when there's meteorological areas, we issue what's called a SIGMET or significant meteorological event.
Yeah.
They issue these to very large areas where it's like, I don't know, weather could happen here. Today. And they make it for a time block and they say, this area is going to have turbulence, thunderstorms, all sorts of things could happen anywhere in this big giant area. Be aware of that. And taking them seriously. And that means that any weather that does present itself within that SIGMET should be considered very dangerous.
Significant, one may say.
Yes.
Weird.
Again, 2 pages and they're talking about all this and talking about all the different organizations that should also take this into mind and take it to recommendations to the aircraft. Now, to everybody who flies, turbulence, I will argue, is still the most dangerous occurrence in aviation this day and age, in commercial aviation this day and age. Not dangerous in the sense that an aircraft is going to crash from it, but it is very dangerous for you because severe
That's
turbulence...
That's how people get hurt.
Severe turbulence is worsening all the time. And that's being proven by the number of very severe turbulence events that are happening to aircraft. And the aircraft can absolutely withstand it. They're built that way these days. However,
you can't withstand
it. You cannot withstand it, so please wear your friggin' seatbelt.
This is why you should always be wearing your seatbelt, even right. when the seatbelt sign is not on.
Right.
Because sometimes you hit stuff and they don't know.
Right.
And they have to wait till you hit it. Turn on the seatbelt sign.
Yep. Once in a blue moon, too, something happens where, like, that Delta flight we were talking about flies through a thunderstorm it's not supposed to fly through. That doesn't really happen anymore. I mean, even that instance was so
weird.
Watched after in aviation that after that happened, everybody was like, yeah, again, Don't fly through it.
Don't fly through thunderstorms.
Just don't do it. And they don't anymore.
No.
There's a lot of actually procedures now that air traffic control have a little bit more control over that says, should there be severe weather on radar, there are very specific areas, very specific types of weather that they have to deviate aircraft around. And the aircraft, again, yeah, sure, captain still has control of the aircraft. It's up to them to make decisions. But basically, they have to fly around it. And the air traffic controller makes them.
Yeah. All right, people. That was Brana flight. I don't remember.
352.
352.
Trivia.
Trivia!
Okay, so...
there's been a lot of responses to this.
There were more this month than I think we've ever gotten before, which makes me kind of happy.
I agree.
Who was the first person to answer? Oh, Bob was happy that you called him Bobbert.
So. Bobbert.
I think Bob's the first one who answered. And then mm-hmm. Cheryl.
Yep.
And then Oliver. And then Kevin.
I see Leo. I see...
oh, I don't see Leo.
Kaylin. And I see JJ.
Okay, those are the most recent then.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll open Kaylin's.
All right. So the first question was, which airline... no one got this right, by the way.
Oh.
Which airline introduced online check-in in 1999? And a lot of people said Alaska Airlines, but that's not right.
No, and I have... JJ said American.
It's
Southwest.
Southwest.
Really? I thought it was Alaskan.
Southwest was the first airline with a website, and then they never changed it after that. That's not true, by the way. But they have like the most antiquated systems.
That's the answer we have on our document.
Is Google says Alaskan, also in 1999.
Both of them then.
So maybe it was a race.
But anyways, the funny thing about Southwest to me is just the fact that like, They really hit home and really hit hard with this whole, like, we have a website and you can book online now. And they were, like, super touting this. And they were like, look, the first airline to be, like, big on the internet. And it worked for them. But then for some reason...
nothing has changed since.
But then for some reason, everybody else has got ahead of time here and, like, worked with the future. And they are so antiquated with everything they do. All of their systems just suck. They're old. Even their app just feels clunky and old.
Kaylin answered, LOL, this was literally a question at your wedding and I don't remember.
It was.
Yep.
Bob's specific answer was Alaska Airlines, presumably to allow their customers more time for important stuff like fighting off bears and seeing Russians.
I like it. All right.
What did JJ say?
American.
Oh, he said American. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then, I mean, there's other stuff. We can look at them quickly as we go through, but what aircraft can carry the most passengers? Now, Bob had a slight dissertation on this.
Oh my God, Bobbert.
He says, technically, the A380, which is correct. Is
yes, Leo said the same.
With a maximum rating of 850 plus passengers. But,
he says,
but El Al did manage to shoehorn 1,086 passengers onto a 747 in 1991.
And I said this actually when we brought this up in the trivia question. So thank you for bringing that up.
Two of said passengers were heavily pregnant at the time, and the flight landed with 1,088 passengers.
Yep. That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. That's always one of my favorite facts is like the A380, yes, technically.
How are they allowed to do that?
They were, this is a wartime thing. They were getting refugees out.
Oh, it was refugees.
It's a cargo airplane that they just stuck a bunch of people in with no seats.
That makes sense.
They all just sat on the floor or stood.
Dude, we did stuff like that when pulling out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah. These kinds of things happen in war zones, and that's where like law and regulations start getting really gray. So,
yep.
Well, whatever.
Kaylin said, depends on how many weight and balance guidelines we ignore.
Yeah.
No, because A380s, I guess it depends on where you are then. If it's really hot, you can't put that many
right.
people on. But she said, probably the biggest one.
Yeah, yes. Which to that end, JJ said, and I'll read this one out. Now the question is, what plane can carry the most passengers? That is the Airbus A380. However, theoretically, if you put seats in the Antonov An-225, you could probably fit more people into that.
Hey, guess what?
You never specifically said passenger planes.
That's gone.
Yeah. Also, the A380 is still the biggest airplane now.
Destroyed.
I mean, it's actually not the biggest airplane by size in total, but it is.
Leo also said the A380. For the previous one, he guessed Delta.
Yes, I know.
It would definitely not Delta. Boo-boo.
No.
Sublight for the first one said Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And said the A380.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl said Alaska for the first one and A380 for the second one.
Yes.
And Oliver said should be Alaska Airlines. and gave a dissertation for the next one. Okay. Yes, you mean the A380, although it isn't usually configured to max capacity.
Correct.
The Boeing 747SR, the Japan Airlines variant, comes close to the typical configuration of a 380, although not quite, though. If it is a question of how many people one could cram in an emergency, I'd go with a transport military aircraft like the unfortunately late Antonov An-225.
Yep.
Or the C-5, although the C-5 appears to have a smaller load capacity than the A380. Holy cow, just now realize how huge the A380 actually is, and that beast is a civilian passenger plane?
Yeah, it's crazy.
How can one get that thing in the air, especially in a scheduled airline service? So why has the A400M so many problems? They should know that what they are doing, shouldn't they?
Yep.
Nope.
The A380 is really impressive. To me, always been the most impressive thing about it isn't even the fuselage, which, don't get me wrong, is huge, but actually is the wing. Because it definitely has the largest both surface area and volume of pretty much any wing that's ever been built ever. Only comparable to the Spruce Goose.
Ah, the Spruce Goose. Okay, third question was how many of us wear glasses?
No one.
Including the staff.
No one got this right.
No one got it right.
Nope.
But I will read you the answer. We will read you the answers and then we will tell you the correct answer.
Yes.
Bob goes, ah! Everyone except Miranda, I think, which technically is correct.
Oh, so he did get it right.
It is technically correct, yes.
Caitlin said three, easy. No, false.
No, I wasn't.
Four.
I wasn't done. He wrote a small dissertation.
Oh.
But glasses are cool, you know? I bet Miranda is totally jealous of us. Imagine missing out on exciting stuff like going partially blind every time you enter a warm room on a cold day. She don't know what she'd be missing.
So I lied. Bobbert did get it
Bobbert
correct.
Bobbert got it right.
Yes.
JJ says, now I am relatively new, so I want to say Nick and Chrissy are the only two that wear glasses. So too. Of the hosts, you are correct.
Yes. Not of the, we said including staff, though.
Yes.
Leo said, I know Nick and Chrissy wear glasses, so I'll go with three.
Yep.
Cheryl said, no idea because I don't know which staff wear them, but I'm going to set the over-under at 3.5 and take the under. Pretty sure Nick and Chrissy both wear them, but otherwise I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sublight says, guessing Nick and Miranda plus Paige, and they're lovely. Paige is lovely.
See, when I got glasses, which was only a few years ago for the first time, it was so funny because when I walked into work the next day and anytime I saw anybody, they'd look at me a little funny, but not one person ever said, is something different?
It's because you look like you're supposed to be wearing glasses.
I don't know. It's weird. Like that changed literally one day to the next. It was like a Tuesday into a Wednesday. I went from no glasses to glasses. And people would kind of like double look at me and be like,
there's something different.
But nobody would say that.
Yeah.
Nobody. Nobody went, did you get a haircut or something different about you? Nobody. So I never got the chance to be like, shing, glasses.
Unlike me, wow. Where Chrissy got a different shape of glasses. And I was like, what the f*** is wrong with your face? I was like, something is wrong with your face.
You did stare at me for 2 hours before saying
something. I literally
was
like, there is something wrong with her face. It's different. Something is different. And then I figured it out. It was your glasses.
See,
shape.
For you, I feel like, I mean, I'm used to seeing you both with and without your glasses, so it doesn't.
You're the only person used to seeing me without my glasses.
But that's
the
whole thing.
I think you
look
weird without your glasses.
And that's the whole thing is like, I think there are people who look a little strange without their glasses. And then there's people like me who it's kind of like, doesn't make a difference. I don't know. Doesn't really make that much of a difference. Like, people didn't really notice when I did because it didn't make a difference.
It's just weird.
She took off her glasses.
It's just because I'm used to seeing you with glasses.
So the correct answer is everyone but Miranda.
Yeah, I don't wear glasses.
Caitlin often wears contacts.
Yes.
But she does wear glasses.
She is also partially blind.
Right. 3 out of 5 of us wear them full time. 1 out of 5 of us wears them part time. And 1 doesn't wear them at all.
Nope. But I will when I get older.
Yep.
So there you go.
There you go.
Okay. Last question. What is the oldest airport in New York City, the New York City metropolitan area, still operating today? Now, this is what Bob said, which makes me laugh a little bit. He goes, my brain keeps shouting, trick question, trick question, trick question. It's not. It's New Jersey.
It is New Jersey.
at me. So I'm going to say Teterboro, which has been open for 100 years.
Correct.
Which is correct. It's Teterboro.
Caitlin says one of them for sure.
Yeah. JJ said the oldest airport in the New York metropolitan area, I hope in LaGuardia. But I for some reason think I heard y'all say at some point it was Teterboro. But I'm going to go with LaGuardia.
Yeah, should have gone with
you
Teterboro.
You should have gone with Teterboro. You are correct. We did say that out loud, which is why it's in here.
Leo says LaGuardia. He didn't know for sure. Kevin says Teterboro. Good, good. Proud of you.
Cheryl said Teterboro, and then there was a whole other thing, but it has nothing to do with the...
We should put in what was the name of Denver's old airport, and y'all can't cheat on these, by the way.
Oh, yeah. If you look them up, that's cheating.
Oliver said...
The fun of this is guessing.
Oliver said, don't know too many airports in the New York metro area, so my guess would be Teterboro. Good job!
Good job.
Teterboro.
The one out of the four major airports in the metro area that doesn't have commercial traffic. And I say that... meaning it doesn't have airline regularly scheduled passenger traffic.
Quick shout out to everyone at the wedding who was about my height being one of the trivia questions and it being wrong. It was not my fault. It is in here correctly. Yeah. It is in our list correctly. So Cody messed it up.
So he messed it up.
What happened?
Apparently everyone was pissed in the trivia questions at the wedding because the correct answer, according to the trivia, was not actually correct. It listed my height as 5'8".
Yeah, I put 5'8". No.
5'9".
I knew you're up there. Listen, it's hard for me because everyone's taller than me. I'm like, taller than me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because the question was also, wasn't it like, I didn't see the question, but wasn't it like, what's the difference in height between me and you?
Something like that.
And
no, it actually asked, what is Christy's height?
Oh, okay. Because I thought somebody had said something about what was the difference in our height.
Derek said that.
And people thought.
Because yours was on there too, is how tall you were and how tall you were.
Right. And so people thought it was like, I guess that's probably why people thought it was like the difference was incorrect because he had it listed as 3 inches different.
We should put my height in there now, too, since I am also, now this is not for the wedding.
Yeah.
All right, people, we're going to end this so we can do a short post episode and go to bed because we got work tomorrow.
Yeah.
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 Thank you so much for listening. We do appreciate it. Make sure you check out the Patreon. I know we plug it every time, but there's so much stuff on there. And I really think a lot of you would enjoy it. So check it out.
Yeah.
Even if you check out the free stuff first and then do Patreon, for sure, my dudes. But like, I'm telling you, people are missing out on the blooper reel stuff. Like, it's good stuff.
They really are. It is really good stuff.
Dude, last episode was unhinged.
Oh my God. It happens every now and then.
We'll get into that in the post episode. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you. And we hope you have a safe and healthy week. And we'll catch you all next week.
Keep your speed up.
Please like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Hard Landings Podcast and on Twitter at Hard Landings Pod.
Subscribe and leave a 5-star review on the platform you are using to listen.
If you would like to see photos and sources for this episode, please visit us at hardlandingspodcast.com, where you can also leave us feedback and ask questions.
This episode was researched and written by Nick and Christy and edited by the lovely Paige.
Our theme song was written by Miranda and performed by all three of us plus Leo.
And our logo is by Naomi.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.